This is the Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com. This week, talking to Benjamin Boyce.
If we can just chat, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What's your background?
I'm from Yorkshire, England, and I was raised by what I now think of as kind of closet aristocracy. Like my grandfather was Fabian. I don't know if you know anything at all about Fabian society. Most people don't. But their emblem, I was going to actually get into this because it's relevant to the subjects we're hopefully going to be discussing. Their emblem is a wolf in sheep's clothing. All that, that means is, I mean, all that that implies, I've discovered, is quite true about the Fabian society. But I had no idea about that when I was growing up. But I did know that they were referred to, or we were referred to, as champagne socialists, as in very rich people who espoused socialist values but lived, more like an aristocracy.
Do you think that that corresponds with, what's his name, Orwell, and his critique of socialism, of the bougie class that espouse these socialist ideas, but at the same time really dislike the plebs?
That's a dead match. I don't know if Orwell, he was definitely aware of the Fabians. He was aware of one of my grandfather's associates, Richard Ackland, and who was one of these socialists, Fabian linked, whether he was actually a Fabian. And Orwell considered that Ackland and his movement had the potential for a new kind of fascism. I know that. So, I mean, that does seem to directly intersect with what we're seeing now. And this is, my wife was pointing out yesterday that because I grew up in that background, I grew up surrounded by apparent leftists espousing leftist values, but at the same time, I could see that their lifestyles and their real attitudes didn't match those values. It feels as, well, she was suggesting that I have a trained eye now for seeing that in our culture. The contradictions are very obvious to me in the whole progressive politics and how it's kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing. It seems to be, I was just writing in notes actually for one of my first questions to you, like how the leftist is a kind of anti-establishment position, and yet these values are now establishment values, and the weird paradox of that, and how so many liberal progressives don't see that. They're still talking as though somehow they're fighting to change the establishment and they're in the minority, but actually those values have been incorporated and assimilated by the establishment, or maybe even were sourced in the establishment. And we're seeing the ways in which those values have not made society a better place at all. But
does that correspond? I don't really understand neoliberalism. It gets thrown around, but it seems like it's a dressing up of conservative values in a more palpable form.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's
I don't understand neoliberalism either, but I do wonder if this is almost built into the rhetoric now, or even the politic, that somehow you can't understand it because it's so inherently contradictory. But I also just don't understand neoliberalism because I haven't done enough reading about it. But it seems so, yeah, like neoliberalism was kind of the new face of liberalism, which was really like the old face of, I don't even know what to call it now, because I don't want to say the patriarchy, or because that's now become it's getting harder and harder to talk using the rhetoric, that's for sure.
I guess there's so many different actors, and we don't really know if they're honest actors or if it's kind of like an emergent system, like some sort of Darwinian, just like self-generating coagulation of memes. So I don't know, like, if we can ascribe like maliciousness or even intentionality to the rhetoric itself, and how it might just be that certain people act in a certain way and speak in a certain way, and their actions give them power and their speaking gives them power, but the actions and the words don't necessarily have to line up in order for their influence to progress. Right? Mm-hmm. So it might be the case because of the West being the West, or in this stage of the Enlightenment, that there's certain things that ring true for us, and there's certain sorts of rhetoric that we agree with and that we find palpable, and then certain behaviors that end up having like a monetary gain or a material gain. And as long as you say these things and appear this one way, you can act in this other way, and you maximize both your capitalistic capital and your socialist capital. And by socialist, I just mean your cultural capital at the same time. It might be just like some sort of accident in the way that we perceive things and operate, that it's not like a intentional hypocrisy. It's just, that's what's rewarded.
Yes. This is a question to, I have personally about my own background, my own family. Like, did my father or my grandfather know, were they being intentionally hypocritical or were they not? And my own sense, intuitively and deductively, is that my grandfather was more conscious about it. And my father didn't realize this, that even my father was tricked by my grandfather. So my grandfather was, he started a dairy business, and that became a multinational conglomeration called Northern Foods. And my father was pulled into that. I say pulled into because he really didn't want to, but he ended up taking over the business and making it an even bigger business called Northern Foods, and like a huge business. And my father espoused these socialist values, you know, growing up with him. He did have them, and he got them from his father. But my father also hated his father, and he hated being a businessman. He never felt good about being a businessman, and basically, he was really divided his whole life. He was also a physical cripple. He ended up in a wheelchair and really just not a happy man at all. And the more I looked into his past and my grandfather's history, the more I began to deduce and intuit that part of my father's condition and his hatred of his father was around this question you're raising, that he had inherited perhaps a conscious hypocrisy unconsciously. So he was trying to reconcile that in himself, like these two sets of values, the fact that, or it's not really a fact, but the possibility that his own father had lied to him and pretended to be something that he wasn't. And actually, I mean, to really cut to my own personal chase, I think my grandfather was probably involved in intelligence work, was a kind of spook. And of course, those are trained liars. It's their job to lie. And my sense with the Fabian Society also, that it's very intricately embedded in the British intelligence community. So it's not just a political, much less a philanthropical movement. It's also a social engineering movement, which is embedded in intelligence work. And so lying is just part of, that's the MO of that. They lie and they pretend, they create false movements, they create false fronts, you know, and philosophies that can be useful as shoehorns for agendas. And you see this in the British welfare state, such as it is. Perhaps I shouldn't use terms too loosely because I don't necessarily understand the mechanics of it, but because the Fabian Society created the Labour government.
Okay.
Right? The Labour government came out of the Fabian Society. So that's the left wing of politics in England. But as you may know by now, the left was Tony Blair and whatever. I mean, they're just as right wing as the Conservatives. They're just a different, just as Hillary Clinton is just as right wing as, well,
yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, it seems as though they're both serving the same agendas, just in different ways. And that became apparent with I think, to most British people with the last few, the New Labour and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And now, what's the history of the Fabians or Fabianism? Is it like a ideology or is it kind of an order like the Masons?
It's not quite. It wasn't really a secret society. It started the main at the beginning of it was certain very influential cultural figures like George Bernard Shaw, Virginia Woolf, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, Havelock Ellis, the sex researcher, and it was right coincided with the time that Marx was in London, so it was closely tied to George Bernard Shaw's interest in Marx and Marxism, and an attempt to sort of create a more user-friendly version of Marxism. But it was very particularly in the arts, I'd say, like it was, and they were wealthy people, cultural people, who they call themselves permeators, and their goal was to introduce people at different levels of society, but particularly people in positions of power, to their ideas and to infiltrate different levels of society. And the Fabian, it comes from the Roman Emperor Fabius, whose method was very slow, gradual conquest. Like he was mocked in the early stage of his career because he was just seen as a procrastinator or coward or whatever it was. Like this is never going to work. But eventually it turned out it did work. Like he would starve the enemy and so on and so forth. He had various methods that were the tortoise that beats the hare kind of thing. You just need to bide your time.
What's the goal then? Just to rule or to shape society in a certain way?
Yeah, to shape society in a certain way.
Which would be like a kind of a mixture of socialism and capitalism, or like an oligarchy with socialist principles, or
That seems reasonable. I mean, I would be very hesitant to try and reduce it to a single thing, so I'm going to just go along with that one. Yeah, I mean, it's cryptocratic. There is a it's an oligarchy that's a cryptocracy, but there's also a hide in plain sight thing. I guess it's the wolf in sheep's clothing again. They can let themselves be seen as cultural influence, like George Bernard Shaw. Another one is Bertrand Russell. Like he's considered a humanist to this day, but if you look at his work and you look at it in the context that I'm talking about of social engineering, he had a very different philosophy than the one that is generally attributed to him. It was about elitist rule, and the ends justify the means. And the vast majority of the people are just sheep who have to be manipulated for their own good.
So your father was, or your grandfather seems like, in your depiction, seems like this force of nature, like this very powerful figure, knows what he wants, knows what he's doing, very intentional with his whole thing, with his business practices, and then with his political leanings. Your father, you said, was trying to reconcile inherent contradictions, perhaps, in the ideology, and then how to actually implement that. Does that lead to you going from your watching your father struggle to reconcile into you resisting openly or intentionally and not worrying about trying to harmonize these things or building a more firm and direct critique of the problems?
Well, lately it's been that. To begin with, I just, there was no way I was ever going to join the family business. I didn't adopt, socialist or leftist values, except in, I mean, certain broader ways, certainly like what's considered politically correct now, although my father, ironically, was very scornful of that. But I mean, embracing homosexuality and whatever, just minority and anti-racism and those kind of basic tenets I certainly adopted very young age and never really questioned until recently. But I was completely opposed to the whole family business thing, and even at 20 I disinherited my money. Like that was how I felt oppressed by the inheritance. It wasn't a conscious thing. I didn't associate the money with these values. I just felt the money was somehow trapping me, and so I got rid of it. But later, with with hindsight, I could see that I understood intuitively that the money had all these hooks in it, and I was trying to get free of a whole ideological mindset. But that only became conscious in the last few years when my brother died. Actually, he died of a heroin overdose, and his self-destruction was so dramatic and so flamboyant, and I just felt, I knew, because I knew him obviously, that it, there was something that wasn't being acknowledged even by him. There was something, because his death was almost celebrated. Like, he was this dandy who's a celebrity and lived this lifestyle as a heroin addict who saw prostitutes all the time and so on and so forth, this decadent figure. And so his death was the logical consequence of his life. And his death was even somewhat celebrated in the media, as in, this is, he died the way he lived, and this was artistic self-destruction. And that appalled me so much that I wanted to get to the bottom of it. And the bottom ended up being, actually predictably, ancestrally, my grandfather, who had a sort of close relationship with my brother and who introduced my brother to a notorious criminal, the Jimmy Ball and the Glaswegian underworld. And that was the point at which my brother's trajectory changed, I think, that eventually led to self-destruction. So that was kind of the lead to me. Well, how did my brother self-destroy? Partly due to this connection to this Glaswegian criminal, who is, that's a whole can of worms, of course. And he met him through my grandfather. So I just, let's look at my grandfather more closely. Yeah. And then I discovered all this Fabian stuff. And it did make sense of my brother's self-destruction. Absolutely. Okay. It did help me understand it. And the hypocrisy is at the core of it. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And so that's a big change to take, then, to disinherit yourself and, I guess, to give up one level of life into another level of life. Do you know where you were headed when you disinherited your inheritance?
Yeah, well, I was literally headed to Morocco. I wanted to just go somewhere where I would have to struggle to survive, literally, and not just eat, but I mean that I would be in danger constantly. As a Westerner in Morocco, I just felt I need to fight for my survival, otherwise I'm going to go under. I mean, this wasn't just about family stuff. This was also an emotional crisis I was in, clearly. But essentially, I needed to break myself down and build myself up again from the foundation, because I intuited that the foundation was just this swamp of hypocrisy and lies and abuse.
And what was your trajectory then? You went to Morocco and then you returned to the West, or are you still in Morocco?
No, this is many years ago. So this is almost 30 years ago now. So my trajectory would obviously take too long to go into, but it did end up, a long period of vagabundery, really, and even kind of spending time at monastery and things like that. So a bit of a classic pilgrimage life, but it's ended up with me living in a small town in Canada, running a thrift store which helps feed the poor and the homeless and stuff. It's not a charity, we just do that because it's a logical step, because there are so many people like that coming into the store, so of course we help them. But the irony, or the whatever you call that symmetry of it, is that this is the very thing that my own ancestors, my father, my grandfather, disowned. They didn't want to mix with they didn't want to live socialist values. I'm not socialist. I'm anti-socialist, but I'm living the supposed socialist values. So it's very ironic.
Well, how are those? That's an interesting point, that you're living socialist values even though you're anti-socialist. So I wonder if you mean like socialism as a governmental structure you disagree with, but socialism as a way of life, of connecting with your fellow man and living a life of service.
Yeah, and just practically helping people in need because one can. I mean, I don't see that as socialist values. I don't. I'm just saying. Yeah. So that's why I say I'm anti-socialist. I just mean, I mean, I, I, I'm anti any kind of ism in a sense, although I'm also anti being anti, because then you take a position, right?
No, I'm exactly in the same thing. I'm even anti being anti too. I'm just like this tightrope of clowns to the left of me, Antifa to the right, kind of trying to throw
Well,
that meme.
that's the liminality. That's the thing I write about and name the podcast about, is being liminal, being able to just stay on the threshold and stay between extremes and walk that line.
And why did you reach out to me then? How did you find me, and
I found
why
you
are you?
through my wife, which is how I find many spokespeople in this particular field anyway. Whatever we would call that. What would we call it? What do you call it? What do you consider yourself to be doing?
I get, well, there's no clean way of putting it. I guess one part independent journalist, one part heavily quoted public intellectual, and then one part, I guess, performer or showman, kind of thing. So it's a mix, but
So, but your focus is on social commentary, right? And then specifically, although you could say this is all there is to comment on in a certain sense, but specifically the what would you say? How would you describe specifically what it is that you're primarily commenting on?
What I'm engaged with is from a particular mode of acting, which is close reading, basically leaning on my literary expertise or practice. I look at what can be called social justice or progressivism as it manifests in the media, from op-eds to videos, to even like TV shows. And as well, I look at that stuff that as it manifests in academia, and probably other places too, but academia and the media are the main two things that I look at. And then I unpack that and I look at it and I reason through things, trying to take the good ideas and trying to really spell out why I think the bad ideas are bad, or the bad behaviors are bad.
So how much was this sparked by your experience at Evergreen?
Evergreen State College is in Olympia, Washington. It's quite known in the area. It's always been known in the area as being very, very progressive, very, very left, very, very liberal. And I ended up there kind of like in the middle of my life, my late 30s, went back to college to, try to figure out what I was doing, because I was having kind of a crisis of, of character. And I entered into it after years working just Joe Jobs and playing around with words on my own. And when I entered into there, I was kind of taken aback by how regressive it felt they were in their progressivism, how it seemed like I'd stepped back into the PC culture of 1995, 96. And it was just like the same ideas. And I was kind of like laughing it off. And I'd find older people there, because there's actually a lot of older people that end up at Evergreen because of the education model and because of how much they want to work with you as a student to craft your own degree. So I'd find people and we kind of make fun of it, and kind of unpack it. But as time went on, and this is from 2013, and I graduated in 2017, I saw that this progressive ideology, this social justice ideology, was getting rowdier in the media, rowdier on other campuses, and rowdier at Evergreen. And by rowdy, I just mean like more ostentatious, more in your face, like, kids. I think of them as kids. It's hard for me to think of them as young adults because of the way they're acting and the way that they cognate is just very rudimentary. They would just show up to different meetings and shut things down and scream and rant and, throw their temper
I've
tantrums.
seen the videos, yeah.
You've seen the
So,
videos,
yeah.
and it culminated in a 3 or 4 day protest where they protested a professor of evolutionary biology, Brett Weinstein, and then they literally took over the library administration building. They blocked the doors. They rounded up teachers. They locked them, or they they blockaded them into a room. They basically kidnapped things, and they demanded all these things. And before that had culminated, I saw it starting to get bigger and bigger, and I tried to speak out about it in very minute ways. But in my head, I was thinking about it and getting ticked off about it and connecting with people on the internet and seeing how people were responding to it on the internet, such as Jordan Peterson and other people, because Jordan Peterson had been protested in the fall of 2016, I believe, and my campus erupted in the spring of 2017. And I was trying to say that the way that you're teaching this social justice stuff is leading to behavior that's not just, and it's antisocial, and it absolutely helps no one. And then you guys are so short-sighted that you don't understand the ramifications, the public ramifications, when the public sees that you guys are enabling this. And I'm not speaking to the students, I'm speaking of and to the administration and to the faculty and to the staff. Like, you guys are enabling infantile behavior. Mm. And one of the things that I did in my adult life was work in preschool. So I did a lot of acculturation and a lot of training people, training very small people to interact with other people in a way that's harmonious and beneficial for all. And I saw that the exact opposite was being empowered there, and all under the guise of how Western civilization in America is fraught with injustice and oppression and racism, and magnifying all those negative things, but at the same time saying that they're against it, right? I was denied a job in the writing center, and this is somebody I had, by that point I had written like 19 or 20 novels, just like, and shelving them and writing and shelving and writing. I'm not published at all. I just write as a hobby. But I have, you know, 20 years of experience writing, and I took the class to be a writing tutor. And when it came down to, you know, doing an interview, you know, I have all the qualifications. And then they asked me, well, what do you think about anti-oppression? What's your stance on anti-oppression? Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, here goes my job. What's the one thing that anti-oppression needs in order to function? The one thing it needs is oppression. And if it doesn't see it, it will invent it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to, I don't believe in an education model that thinks of itself as some sort of palliative for injustices or some sort of psychological help session. I'm here to teach people how to write and to communicate clearly so they can actually get ahead in the world. I'm not here to unpack my privilege and their underprivilege. I'm not going to do that. That's a waste of my time, and I didn't get hired. But the college itself self-selected for people who were not critical but fully embracing of this ideology. And so it developed for itself a blind spot where it could not see the faults in the ideology, and then the faults in the behavior, that once these students took over the campus, had their mini little revolution, and live streamed the whole thing to the internet, the administration and the staff and the faculty, not all of them, but enough of them to count, or the enough of them that this is the way it happened, they were unable to see that they were at fault and that the kids had acted badly, and that you can't act that way and stream it to the internet without a backlash. So what they unfortunately did was pin everything, blame everything on Brett Weinstein, who was accused of being a racist, and who ended up speaking to the media. And they accused all the unrest and all the hate from the internet and all the hate from the world on Brett Weinstein as a way to continue to cover themselves and to keep that blind spot nice and comfortably there.
Mm-hmm. So then they made Brett Weinstein a star.
Well, they tried to make him a scapegoat, but they made him a star. Yeah, I mean, it totally backfired. And that's how I started talking about it, because the internet erupted with commentary on it, but nobody was on the inside. So I started to unpack everything and take out training videos and seminars and lectures and just show, like, look, this is the kids are not to blame. They're just having their I'm a 20-year-old rock star moment. It's the faculty. It's the administration. It's how the college thinks and what the college is teaching. And so that's kind of how I got launched into cultural commentary.
I got a 9-pound. I got a 9-pound. I'm gonna
things I think Weinstein said recently, Weinstein, is that if you want to see real progressive, look at the administrators, like their way beyond what we're seeing with the students. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So then that begs the question, what are the students protesting against?
That's the total irony with a lot of these college protests. It's so ironic. Like any sort of classical Marxist or classical leftist even will look at their behavior, and not just at Evergreen. Evergreen, for whatever reason, is just the exemplar of what's happening at other institutions, at colleges and then at these big tech corporations, where they are nominally anti-authoritarian. Right, they hate the cops, they hate the police, they hate the structure, but they feel very unsafe, and their whole shtick is an appeal to more authority.
They
hate the administration, but they want more administration. They want more people servicing them, but they want those people to think a certain way and to be a certain color. You know, so they want an authoritarian regime, but at the same time, like, they're anti-authoritarian. You know, they want anti-racism. Yeah, but they're the most racist people. They want anti-oppression. They're engineering oppression. That's the students, right? But where does that ideology come from? And I think that it gets kind of more complex when you look at how the administration is enabling it, especially at colleges. Like, are the administrators necessarily more progressive than anybody else? No, I think that they are looking at the bottom line, and it's much more risky to be anti-progressive than it is to be progressive. It's much more safe to be progressive. So they kowtow to progressivism. I think that there's a case to be made that they're just following market forces.
Well, and so what were you studying at Evergreen?
I studied, you design your own thing. I tried to develop an intersection of critical and creative writing under the umbrella of what I think of as narrative arts, which means, how do you build stories? How do you take apart stories? And then what do stories do in the world and in the imagination and stuff like that? So psychology and linguistics and literature. And I would always put all of my lessons into a piece of creative writing. So I wrote like 5 little novels while I was there, like practicing what I was preaching or wanted to preach.
Right. And so you have some background in psychology?
I don't have a background. I just studied it through the lens of what a narrative does. So it's not necessarily what we think of as psychology. It might be more social psychology. And I have some kind of I have some theories of literature which fold into theories of religion and fold into theories of psychology. I think there's even something called narrative psychology, where what you're trying to do is help somebody build a framework of themselves situated in the world. So we can just look at how human consciousness operates, and I believe it operates through narrative, which is just, there's a self situated among other selves, with a bunch of objects and situations and a world and a history, right? And so a narrative consciousness precedes rational consciousness. It precedes any other sort of consciousness other than just like basic human just awareness. And all my theories are kind of grounded in my experience working with 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds and watching consciousness emerge, and then experimenting with ways of communicating to a human being as it emerges into the social consciousness. And I think that narrative is how you actually, like, you can tell a 2-year-old a story, but you can't tell them a math problem, right? They don't understand grammar. They couldn't explicitly tell you how grammar works, but they're grappling with it and they're using it. But like, you can communicate ideas, morality, behaviors through a narrative framework before you ever get to Kant, right? Or anything advanced like that or abstract like that.
So a 2-year-old, what kind of narrative can a 2-year-old enjoy or comprehend then?
Yeah. Very rudimentary happenings. So it's probably about 1.5 to 2. Once they start to grok words, right? And what are words? So there's words that are nouns, words that are verbs, and words that are adjectives. So you start talking about the blue ant that ran through the window and started to spray the room with cheese, and I got stuck to the floor, and the only way I could get away was to eat all the cheese. And now I have a cheese ant in my stomach, and it wants to get out of my belly button, but it doesn't feel really good, so I have to go to the doctor. Right.
Okay.
So if you just break that down into, you followed that, a two-year-old can follow that. It doesn't really make any sense, but it...
No, it's a lot of imagery, is what I'm thinking. Yeah. It's a lot of imagery, and I'm, one of the things I'm curious about around this is the extent to which a narrative through line is related to, connected to the emergence of an I, of a first person, because narratives have a person, right? Whether it's first person or third person. In this case, it's the ant. And at what stage in an infant's or a child's development do they begin to develop a sense of a separate self? Because I think they've read about these experiments, like even up to the age of four, children tend not to realize that they do experiments where they'll have an object in a room and then they'll hide it. And, well, somebody's out of the room and the child doesn't understand that the person who is out of the room doesn't know where the object is, because the child doesn't understand that their consciousness isn't shared by the consciousness of everyone around them. Right? So,
yeah, I guess in a way, narrative is the most rudimentary theory of mind, I think is the term. Hmm. Like a theory of mind is one way of the scientists or psychologists, I'm going to butcher it, I don't know what discipline, but that's one way that they frame consciousness. There's like a theory that there is another consciousness. And how does that emerge? And I think narrative is one way of teaching that, which is a very rudimentary thing for a child to understand. And that's where morality comes from, or ethical behavior comes from. Like, okay, you know, and it's all boiled down to, you know, Jesus or Buddha saying, you know, do unto others as you want them to do unto you, or don't do unto others as you don't want them to do unto you. And understanding that is like how a child navigates from being just like, the world is me, the world belongs to me, everything else is an obstacle to getting what I want, to, oh, there's other me's, and now I have to start to manipulate them, or at least change my behavior in order to get what I want, and learn delayed gratification, just learn all these different things to, in order to master that sociological field, or the game of, you know, many players.
Right. So do you think, I mean, what makes this particularly pertinent, obviously it's pertinent to everything in terms of human existence and never mind social arrangements, but specifically to what we're talking about now, that one of the things that you were seeing at Evergreen and that we're seeing in the world is a kind of arrested development of a very early stage, where you've got the narcissistic ego that feels it has to have complete control over everything that everybody does in order to feel safe.
Yeah, and I think that there's something to be said about individuals versus identities versus the collective, and I think that identity politics is one way for a collectivization to recognize the individual and then force them to sacrifice their individuality for the collective by means of identity, which is just a basic. It's a basic rudimentary box that isn't a real self. It's just a collection of verbs and adjectives and nouns, and then a history of oppression or marginalization or privilege. It's a very rudimentary story. And that, and on an aesthetic level, I don't know if I've necessarily delved into this, but what really disgusts me about it, or what really makes me disappointed in social justice, hyper-progressive theories, is that there's no real good story there. It's just one rudimentary story of victims and victors, right? And if all of society is put in that one plot arc, then you lose so much other narratives. You lose so many other characters. Like, everybody either has to be a victim or a victor, or an oppressor and oppressed. And what kind of characteristics are you allowed to act out? How many characters do you have anymore? The whole world is reduced into this one epic, this one very rudimentary epic that then produces a whole bunch of problems, because there's no room in it for any other sort of character, any other sort of hero, any other sort of arc.
Well, of course, we have. I mean, our popular culture and media entertainment has tended to reduce narratives to just one epic, hasn't it? Just the good versus evil. Okay, there are more nuances, but it's like Darth Vader is Luke's father and stuff. So there's a little bit of nuance in there, a bit of self-awareness. But essentially, it's still the same story playing out, which is that good has to conquer evil in order to.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I mean, yeah, in on one level, yes. Like there's always going to be like a protagonist and then what's the antagonist? Antagonist. And then probably somebody in between. Like there's a triad of like the victim and then the rescuer and the villain or something like that. But what we see happen over and over and over again in advanced societies is that these small little kind of local stories of local heroes eventually get swallowed up, just like local towns get swallowed up by a city state and then by an empire. The same thing happens with our stories. Like you have like just like little characters that come from like this little village, and then they turn into like parts of a story from a city state. So there's storytellers that are talking about all these different characters, and then you have this lore base, and then you have some Alexander the Great of the narrative world that we can call Homer comes in, and he arranges all these different stories from this whole like landmass of these different villages, all these different characters. He arranges them all into one plot arc, right? And that plot arc, that epic story, like let's say the Iliad, is there's conflict in there, but the beauty of Homer is that there's justice on both sides, and there's injustice on both sides, and there's a lot of nuance, and the victor isn't necessarily pure or perfect. But whether or not you have that perfect, clean cutout of the good guys and the bad guys, you have all these different other sorts of characters working out all these other kind of plot arcs. Like one guy's battling with his father. I'm thinking like Lord of the Rings. Like you have Frodo and his journey, but Sam and his journey, and Gollum and his journey, and Gandalf and his journey, and all the characters, they all have their journeys, and they're all arranged within that basic plot arc that you could reduce into good versus evil, or weak good versus strong evil, or something like that.
Because
So,
that's the overriding narrative, isn't it? I mean, I see what you're saying. Yes, there's a lot more nuance, and there's more of a sense of a collective experience in which there are idiosyncrasies and differences and a sort of complex system, but it's still built around, constructed around that overriding homoerotic, Homerian arc of the hero who has to achieve the thing. And I just wonder about that. I mean, this might be a bit of a digression, but as I say, it is my interest is often goes towards this, the intelligence aspect of society, the covert espionage aspect. And I was talking to Douglas Valentine recently, who is a long-time researcher into the CIA and their covert activities and the organized crime aspect of American government. And he talked about Homer and the Homer story and how the CIA, from his researches into them and conversations with them, that's the sort of central myth for the CIA and their propaganda is this Homer Eric, whatever the adjective is, kind of ideological drive of the conquering hero, and that around, or if you embed a culture with the right myth, then you can basically justify these agendas throughout the millennia.
I think I spoke about this in a video where I was critiquing Robin DiAngelo's notion of white fragility. And what happens when these different, or let's take like in, let's venture into problematic territory and say we all have sets of stereotypes for these different races and kind of like Canada and in America, right? And stereotypes are bad, right? But you have like Asian stereotypes, like you have a geeky Asian who's a math whiz, or like a controlling mother, which is like another Jewish stereotype. Like there's a controlling mother and like a very hardworking, tight-knit family. You have the stereotypical WASP person who's kind of going to have a midlife crisis because everything is work, like they're working out that Protestant Calvinist kind of work ethic thing. Then you have you have these different stereotypes, positive and negative, that get attached in our minds to different races, right? But you can break that down into different cultures. You know, just like, let's subtract race and say, what is it about the cultures that produce different sorts of stereotypes in the minds of people from other cultures? What a stereotype is the working out of a certain program on a cultural level. And the program is a narrative. The program is like a certain sort of behavior wins the prize, right? So why Asians are just completely trouncing everybody else in test scores is because I think their culture has a certain sort of myth, a certain sort of narrative, and I don't know where that narrative is because I'm not really versed in Asian culture, but I'm sure that you could probably find certain sorts of stories that are being acted out over and over and over again and enforced. And those stories, maybe they don't have a narrative, maybe they don't have a literary equivalent, but within the family unit, there's certain sets of expectations to manifest certain behaviors, to become a certain character, which can then be reduced into a myth or a narrative. So when you take the narrative of oppressor and oppressed and you force an entire society, an entire, furthermore, multicultural society, a society built of many, many different cultures interacting, and you stamp it with this one myth, which intersectionality eventually has become, which is that there's the powerful and then the powerless, and the powerful only became powerful because they robbed or they subjected the powerless, which is basically probably Nietzsche talks about this with slave morality, right? And what is that? You can critique it. What is going to be the output? What's going to be output? People aren't going to get along anymore because they're always going to go through, and this is what happened at Evergreen. You go, everybody has mandatory orientations and privilege. And what you do is you go and you look at like, how many categories do I have? And that, and then you calculate, okay, well, I'm a white male, heterosexual. I'm what I am, right? I'm not Benjamin anymore. So I take Benjamin away and I replace it with all these other things. Mm-hmm. And then that will give me my privilege point, score. And then I have to go around and look at everybody else's privilege score and then adjust my behavior, not based on their character. I no longer see their character. I see this black woman who has yellow hair and might be a lesbian. And so then I have to think about all those things and calculate it. I can't just look at a person and see that person and look through all that stuff, not be blind to the color and all these things, but look through that to find that human being that I want to connect with. And then gauge that human being as a good character or a bad character, somebody I can trust, somebody I can't trust. And once you do that, once you separate people into their categories, one, the white man is utterly vilified over and over and over again at Evergreen. That's the one category network, nexus, that you constantly hear jokes about. And people, if you're in that category, you can't talk or you have to watch yourself and suppress yourself. Mm. What happens is that you have people who are historically in oppressed classes, they can act as horribly as they want to, and nobody can stop them. Nobody can keep them in check. Furthermore, and then they can't learn how to act in a way that builds coalitions. Rather, you have to force people into coalitions based on this really rudimentary, divisive rhetoric of privilege and stuff. I kind of got off the point and made a tangent, but I hope I'm making some sort of sense.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Let's start with the last one. Okay, so because it's a very stark point. So it's an easy one to isolate the vilification or punishing, or it's actually in the piece I sent you. This Victor Turner thing about status reversal, and I'm not particularly familiar with anthropology at all. Mm-hmm. I adopted this term liminality in the last few years just because it kept popping up and it kept mm-hmm. seeming to help me to make sense of things, but I haven't read much of the source stuff. And Turner he didn't coin the term, but he first began to apply it in these specific ways anthropologically that I'm referring to here. So what Turner called rites of status reversal is when the underling comes uppermost. At certain culturally defined points in the seasonal cycle, groups or categories of persons who habitually occupy low status positions in the social structure are positively enjoined to exercise ritual authority over their superiors, and they in their turn must accept with goodwill their ritual degradation. That latter they obviously being the superiors. So that played out at Evergreen in quite literal ways, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And I think that one solution of that is to reinsert this whole thing called competency.
Right.
You're decoupling power and the exertion of power from competency. And that's a huge flaw in the story by saying that everybody in power got to power by exploiting everybody that's not in power. Completely overlooks the amount of talent and hard work it took for anybody to gain power. So if you look at where's the first generation privilege, right? Where's the, if we want to say that society is built out of privilege, where does it come from? Let's go all the way back into the caveman days. And let's say that there's one family that was outproducing another family and out innovating them, or had certain sorts of values or prized certain sort of things. That is what got the privilege ball rolling. That's what gets the disparity rolling. So if you want to fix disparity, you give people the tools and the values that produces wealth. You don't just redistribute wealth by saying that all wealth is stolen.
Yeah, sure.
It's zero sum. And how to fix that is to say, okay, if you want power, you have to be competent with power.
Okay, well, so here's where I have a problem with that, and with, because Jordan Peterson says similar things, and the problem I have with that is that I think that we have a society in which what constitutes competence is itself
the cultured.
The context for competence is itself inseparable from power abuse. That there's something in our society that is inherently abusive. In terms of child raising practices, let's say.
Okay, let's get specific. Are you talking about like corporal punishment?
Okay, so the specifics are tricky because I spent a long time looking into this. But there's a writer called Lloyd DeMaus who's written a book called Emotional Life of Nations and Childhood Origins of War. And what he's looked at is that systematized child abuse has existed throughout history. And, to the point of murdering children, raping them, torturing them, beating them, you name it. Things that we, on a surface level, in terms of lip service, we consider horrific and, you know, unpardonable to this day. Like, you can't even spank a child now. It's illegal to spank a child. However, I think that actual child abuse, whether it's sexual or not, is still as prevalent in our society as it's ever been. It's simply that it's not socially condoned. So it's still occurring. And I think it's occurring at an institutional level. This is one of the things that I was looking into around my family, but I'd already begun to look into it more abstractly, but I began to look into it much closer to home. There is an aspect to the way that society has been ordered and organized that relates to this oligarchy, if you like, or the cryptocracy, or the hidden aristocracy, or the ruling class. One can give it many different names. And there is a generational aspect to that, as in that power does get passed down through lineages, and sometimes the lineages get concealed, so they're not always overt, like with the royal family, but there does seem to be sort of legacy passing thing going on. And so in England, for example, I grew up, I didn't go to public school. I mean, I didn't go to boarding school, public school. Public means private in England, you know. But it's pretty well known that certainly in the day, it's like my day and before my day, if you went to private boarding school, you would get sexually abused there. Mm-hmm. Like Richard Dawkins talks about it, and he just says it was no big deal. Like, what's everyone making such a fuss about? So it is part of the institutionalized child rearing practices to sexually abuse children. It's not acknowledged. It's seen as an endemic problem, as in the Catholic Church. But what I've come to believe is that it's a deliberate methodology for traumatizing children in order to toughen them up. That's to really simplify it. And I didn't want to go off on this sidetrack because it's a big one, of course. But my point is that what I see with the sort of the oversimplified leftist attitude towards the patriarchy and establishment that you're talking about, which is locked into this narcissistic ego that is totally abusing the power of outrage, of course, we can agree about that, but the essential feeling that they have, which is that the system as it is inherently abusive, I think is correct. I just think that the way that they're identifying it is incorrect, that they've actually been, we could say, tricked and corralled or seduced into using the same tools of analysis and condemnation that have been given to them by the very same powers that they're trying to expose. And that one of the ways we can see that, and this is was the point I was actually just trying to get to really, was that what you're describing, which is that the oppressed want to oppress their oppressors. They don't want to just get free of oppression, they want to become the ones who oppress. And of course, that's obviously no solution. And anyone with a modicum of self-awareness or maturity would see that the answer isn't just to torture and abuse other people to get revenge for feeling that way, of course. Yeah. But that is happening. And so, I think that is somehow built into the system, and one doesn't have to get conspiratorial. One can, I do, but one doesn't have to, because one can also get, I don't know if it would be Darwinian necessarily, but in terms of the systems of human consciousness and narratives that get created. And this is, again, the flaw, I think, in the oppressed blaming the oppressors, because I think, as you were pointing out, they're never, if you create that simplified, oversimplified narrative, you never get to the root of how the oppression began.
And it even flies in the face of a lot of psychological theory about how do you deal with trauma. What percentage of trauma is solved by the reversal of fortune, and how long does that last? If you go around and like a vengeance movie, right, like a Hollywood movie about like somebody whose husband gets killed, some woman's husband and child get killed, and she goes on a tear, and she goes and she kills all the murderers, right? Yeah. The sexes don't matter. At the end of that story, like, has she flushed the trauma from her system? Mm-hmm. Or has she flushed the trauma from our system? And we feel as the audience a sense of justice, but does she, as the protagonist, feel a sense of completion and resolution? I don't know. I think that anti-oppression work, anti-racism work, as it is now being taught through the progressive social justice lens, gives you the sense of the possibility of witnessing resolution outside of you.
Yeah, but by being in the opposite role, you get to reenact the trauma in the position of the abuser rather than the abused.
Yeah.
So it perpetuates it rather than resolves it.
It perpetuates that. And what you end up seeing also happened at Evergreen is a lot of oppressor people, a lot of the white people in this, that's how they calculated it, like black people good, white people bad, everybody else in between. And as long as you're obeying us, you're okay. But what happened is you have a lot of white people forced into this, brainwashed into this, let's say, then like feeling like, okay, I have to submit. That's the way that I fix society, is by divesting myself of pride or money or time or volition or agency. That's how I pay everything back, is by letting, and eventually just letting these people run loose and actually hurting them more than helping them. It doesn't actually, it sweeps everybody up. Even the people who are going to be abused by this system, there's a likelihood that a number of people will feel that it's justice for them to be abused. That's where you get like male feminists and this weird kind of twisted things. Like, you're actually acting against your own benefit, thinking that it's benefiting society, but you're not, because the whole story is broken. It's all sin, no redemption.
Right. Well, it's a bit like an S&M enactment, really, isn't it? We're talking about the people who feel they deserve to be abused. Well, that's the M of the S&M, and then on the other hand, you've got the S. So this isn't, I mean, to bring it back to Turner's thing about the rituals of liminality, this isn't a ritual of liminality. This is more like an infantile acting out, where infants unconsciously imitate their parents, you know, in the worst world, not infants, but, you know, toddlers or whatever, at a certain stage where they're beginning to adopt a narrative and embody a narrative. They will act out the parents' unconscious behaviors just as a way to get attention. But there's no consciousness of it, and so there's no possibility of seeing what's actually being revealed. So bring it back to Turner's thing of the liminal enactment. So what he describes there is that in periods of liminality, it's when a community needs to renew itself, or when people are coming of age, or so specifically, which is what people go to university for. There's a sort of community theatre in which the low status people are given high status temporarily, and that involves having power over the high status, who will willingly submit to that as part of the theatre, so that the low status can try on what it's like to be high status, can experience that power in a safe, controlled environment. They don't have the competency, is the point. They're not actually grown up as adults yet, but they're having a sense of it. Perhaps it's a way to neutralize resentment and, you know, opposition or unhealthy opposition to the authorities, because you see, they don't really have power over me. They just have a certain level of competence that I can respect, but they're confident and powerful enough to be able to surrender their power and act this out because they feel secure. And then afterwards, the order reverts to what it was, but with the understanding that over time, that reversal will happen, as in the power will, they will have to succeed their power as they get older, and then the younger ones grow older and they become more competent, and that's the natural cycle, right?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I wonder if it can be systematized and then instituted on one day. And I think that Evergreen was subconsciously trying to do that. Evergreen, kind of what led, well, one of the things that led to Brett Weinstein being protested was that he stood up against or criticized this ritual where the high become low and the low become high, called Day of Absence. And on the Day of Absence, usually the people of color would go off campus and talk about their experiences, and then they'd come back and everybody would get together. The white people and the people of color would all get together. But in the winter, spring of 2017, the planning committee, I think maybe subconsciously trying to act out this reversal of fortune in order to lead the way to ultimate utopia, maybe, I don't know. But they decided to let the people of color occupy the campus, and the white people have a place to go off campus and convene and learn about their whiteness and learn about all their privileges. Now, there was some communication breakdown in the way that they decided to do this. They took over rooms, they took over entire buildings for the day of absence, and it gave the sense that white people were not supposed to be on campus anymore. Now, nobody said that explicitly, but about 15, 17, 20 teachers required their class to segregate themselves and either participate in campus in this ritual of basically flogging themselves for their heritage. If you go through and you look at all the things, white people are always bad. The white supremacy is like, it's just, it's a part of the way that you're conscious and you're acculturated, right? And white supremacy is the biggest evil in the world. If you actually go through and look at it, there's some nuance when you get there, but if you're white, you need to either not come or denigrate yourself or learn how denigrated you are. If you're black, you need to learn how bad the white people are. Even if you're Asian, you need to learn how Asians are helping white supremacy or how Jewish people are aiding white supremacy, right? So it's this whole narrative that's going on. So in a way, they were trying to enact this reversal of fortune where the low become high and the high become low. And I wonder if there is possibly a way for this to be instituted where the underprivileged get to experience privilege in a symbolic manner, in a community theater manner, where it's contained and safe. But I don't know if that's going to necessarily work and not backfire, because how can you reduce what is called privilege now to something that's actually what is privileged? And what's actually privileged is just being a boring, laborious person. What gives you privilege in this world is being able to work really, really hard, right? And yeah, there's all these inherited systems of oppression and inherited systems of privilege. But ultimately, in order to act out privilege, you just need to be an upper middle class person, which means you just need to have a career and do your bills on time and show up to work every day. It's not really sexy. How do you condense that into something that's really sexy? And by sexy, I just mean theatrical and symbolic.
Well, I mean, to start with your last point, I think rather than the first one, do you think that, let me think about this. It feels to me that one of the things that we're both mapping in our different ways is a sort of an end game scenario.
Yeah,
like exactly. It seems as though ideologies have hit critical mass or something.
Mm-hmm.
That, because you're talking about, okay, so the easiest way is to keep it personal, I suppose. Like, I'm early 50s now, by the way. I think you must be older than you look, because I definitely, you were saying late 30s when you went to Evergreen, so you must be early 40s, huh?
Yeah, early 40s.
Yeah, no, I had you pegged for early 30s, so you probably get that all the time. Anyway, so I'm early 50s, and as a born into money, privilege, absolutely, you know, the classic white privileged male was me, that's me. Because of that, I never felt I would have to become this boring, competent, you know, knuckle down and do all these things. So basically, I had it made. But then it turned out that the way I had it made wasn't the privilege that I had, was a burden. I was oppressed by it. Great irony that the underprivileged never get to realize. And so I stripped myself down. And now, as I say, just in the last few years, in my early 50s, I do... I'm, you know, self-made and self-sufficient, and, you know, running a small business, and it's very mundane. Like, the vision I had for myself 20, 30 years ago, or the person who had that vision would be appalled by what it's turned out that I had to, you know, settle for. Yeah. But the value to me of what it is that I've discovered is that it's very, very, very simple and very, very basic. We have a building, you know, a property rented. It's open for business. People bring the stuff they don't want to anymore. They bring it to us, and we sort it, put it out, and resell it as cheap as we can, generally, to people who do want it. and that's it, right? So that the business we run now could have existed 2,000 years ago.
Oh yeah.
Right? It doesn't require any training, doesn't require any expertise. It does require competency, but competency simply for living and dealing with human beings and recognizing what's junk and what isn't. So really basic, like a 12-year-old could do it, right? So I think my point here is that about the end game scenario, I think we're in a stage in culture where the overcomplexification or the complexification has advanced so far that it's in a state of collapse. And there are, of course, different ways to look at the collapse. I'm not an environmentalist. I don't necessarily believe in global warming. I don't necessarily believe in peak oil. But I do believe that we are seeing a complexification in our culture that's so advanced that the inherent contradictions in ideologies and in attitudes and positions are becoming just so glaring that, to me, it's starkly apparent that people are unable to think coherently.
Well, you know what, there's an argument for religion, and I think I'm not going to attribute it to Jordan Peterson, because I'm sure I had this thought on my own, but there's an idea about religion that religion is a sort of social cohesion. It's not an opiate of the masses. It's kind of like the engine oil of society. It allows the more complex parts to interact safely with the less complex parts. And by that, I mean individuals. Individuals of a high complexity, of high competency, can then interact in a beneficial mode in the same sort of cultural framework with people of a coarser or a denser sort of ability, set of abilities, right? So the guy who takes out the trash can sit in mass with the guy who's running the multinational corporation. And they sit in mass, and they have there's a harmonic resonance through the set of narratives that are enacted through a ritual that put everybody on the same level, right, without diminishing their differences. Like it's a communal ground and stuff. And I think that possibly the postmodern project of trying to find a narrative of narratives, it got sidetracked because only it would take an utter genius to make a narrative of narratives. A true postmodern work would be unfathomably complex to really have all these different narratives and all these different cultures interacting and benefiting from each other and having like an Iliad where every single character is the sum total of every single heritage, right? Where all these different heritages are having like this interaction and stuff, like immeasurably complex. But is there not possibly some sort of overarching narrative? And is that not kind of like what we need in a certain way? Hmm. And that narrative has a abstract form, which would be a set of values, and then a non-abstract form, which could be replicated over and over and over again in media. Like, what would that be? And, you know, I'm just shooting in the dark and stuff, but it seems like, can there be a cohesion of multiple cultures that is not warlike, that is not a bunch of different mind viruses trying to defeat and take over each other? And I think that cultural Marxism or social justice is another mind virus, but it is so, it's not beneficial to any given heritage that it infects. It infects, it's one way of tying everything together by tying it all together in contest, and which therefore leads to destruction. Like, where's the creative cohesion that we can have where somebody who's an Orthodox Jew and an Orthodox Greek can get along and meet and have a beneficial relationship without necessarily diluting their own heritage, but actually, respecting and being enriched by the other heritage? And that might be where, you know, Baha'i or Unitarianism was trying to do that.
Mm. Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, there's the religious principle, say Christian, because that's the religion I'm most familiar with. But I think all religions that acknowledge a deity, because of course now religion can be, you know, Jedi Knight, but the traditional religions, the idea, or maybe it's more than an idea, but the core of it is that there is a higher power that we are subject to, and we cannot judge it by definition, it's so far beyond our comprehension. But nor can we judge ourselves or each other, because it is the judge of value. It is the measure of value and the judge of value. Thereby, it's a great equalizer, but not a uniformer. It doesn't just make everyone the same. It just preaches or prescribes humility.
Yes.
Not just with the divine and our relationship with the divine, but with one another.
Yeah, exactly. It's a perspective. It assigns perspective that's the other problem that I have with social justice, sorry to interrupt, or intersectionality. It's like, what human being can possibly gauge every other human being's privilege in every given situation? You can't do that. It's so inefficient to try to reduce everybody to privilege or to oppression. But it's non-positive. And I think that certain forms of religion ascribe that judgment, like you're saying, both positive and negative, to some sort of transcendent principle, or not just a principle, but like entity or being or force or whatever, that then allows you to connect with the person who's completely different from you by seeing God in them, right? By seeing them as created by God and owned by God and ultimately derived from and returning to that which you yourself are derived from and returning to. And that could even, you can strip the word God out of that and use a evolutionary principle.
There, I'm not so sure about. That's Jordan Peterson again. And I do think that's a slippery slope personally, because I think if you reduce it to a materialistic thing or a biological thing, then you actually invert it. I think you end up with scientism at that point. Which is definitely the prevailing religion of our day, I'd say, is scientism. And I think that this is the problem that you're out underlying here with the postmodernist desire to create the narrative, the uber narrative or the meta narrative that incorporates all narratives. That's traditionally, that's hubris, right? That's actually revolt. That's the kind of Luciferian revolt, saying, you know, we can define our own reality. And interesting, again, there's, like you're pointing out there, the inversion, because like the religious or the acknowledgement of the divine that is in one's life, it doesn't have to be religious, I agree, in the sense of belonging to a religion, because I don't, but I do acknowledge the divine principle, it is, judge not lest you be judged, as in, you can't be going around judging other people, A, because you don't have the wherewithal to do so, and B, because you've got to take care of your state of your own soul, because God's going to judge that. So it would be very impractical for a truly religious person to spend time and energy judging others, because they know that they're not, it's he who's without sin cast the first stone. It's that one, right? And what we're seeing in the social justice warrior, whatever, is the opposite. It's all about throwing as many stones, virtue signaling, as many, the more you can condemn others, the more virtuous you can make yourself appear.
Yeah.
So it's a complete inversion of that.
Yeah, and it allows you to completely skimp out on the responsibility and the hard work, which is going to completely dash your expectations in the end of dealing with your own crap, of perfecting yourself, of like, how do I become a good person, and how do I interact with other people in a beneficial way that I can still live, right? How do I get a real job, live a real life, and increase my reality or increase my virtue, my true virtue, and by that value, not virtue, but value. How do I increase my value? As a human being,
or discover it even. I mean, maybe not about increasing it, but actually discovering it, like clearing away all the crust of ideology and hypocrisy to find out actually that we are in God's image, so to speak.
Or at least through the glass darkly. Let's quote Paul here. but the social justice or whatever it is. Radicalism, activism, you get to run into your marginality. And actually, the more marginality you have, the less you actually have to work at being a better person. I just found on Twitter, somebody on Twitter said, I'm a woman and I'm marginalized, and I'm trans and I'm marginalized, and I'm lesbian and I'm marginalized, and I'm a gamer and I'm marginalized. And it was just so weird. It's like, okay, well, I'm a man, but it's not good enough to be a white man. So now I'm going to turn myself into a woman. So I get those points. And then I get to be trans. So I get those points. And then I get to be a lesbian too. So I get those points. And now I get to attach myself to these other marginalities. It's like, there's no self there, dude. Mm-hmm. There's no self there. She, her, dudette, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this complete, it is completely disrespectful to the person to reduce yourself into identities that way.
Well, ironically, to the so-called classes or marginalities that are being adopted or culturally appropriated as well.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's total appropriation. Uh-huh. And this is the same person who tweeted it back in November that if you're a lesbian and you don't want to have sex with a trans person, you're basically a transphobe, right? So it's this man who's acting like a woman and dressing like a woman, now being very rapey, and then leveraging all his privilege points to get laid, and just completely anti-feminist, like completely like denigrating himself in order to denigrate other people to get some sort of pleasure. Anyways, I don't mean to like go off on this, just as an instance of that ideology, like taken to this degree.
Yeah. One of the dangers I find in what we do, which is examining this culture, is that one can fall into outrage at the outrage of others. Like, it's outrageous how outraged people are acting, right? And that vicious circle, Chinese finger trap sort of aspect of it, I think it's worth talking about, because can one examine? And it's the same with self-examination, like, can one see one's own neuroses, own distortions, one's own hypocrisies, without shaming oneself, without going into compulsive behaviors, you know, to compensate for what one is seeing? Can one just see them and not react to them? That seems to be, to me, that's the potential, or the potential reward of being in this time, is that it's an opportunity. I guess it's very Buddhist, really, isn't it, or Zen or something like that. It's an opportunity to develop equanimity, as in to really be willing to look at the prevailing insanity of our times and not get pulled into it. I think there's a definite mastery that can come from that.
You know, George Bush was the compassionate conservative. I do aspire to be the compassionate critic.
Yeah, same, actually, because I started out as a film critic, and, you know, movies were my ideology. So, like, I would fight to defend the movies in the way that people, not quite, but similar way that people fight to defend their religion. And over the years I've had to realize that critical eye tends to neutralize one's compassionate response, and the compassionate response is more important, but one doesn't want to lose the critical eye. So it's kind of,
well, how do you maintain a balance between those then?
Well, I suppose it's by living. It's a, yeah
yeah Well, the Christian formula is like, love the sinner, hate the sin, or something like that, right?
Well, yeah, like yeah, sure. And I don't think formulas are very good to have generally like that. Do unto others is definitely, in a world of S&M, do unto others, it doesn't necessarily fly, right? So, but I think that you were zeroing, circling around it when you were saying, who's the human being in all this? So even if I'm looking at a movie, it was made by human beings for human beings, there's still a human element. But certainly if I'm looking at somebody who has bad taste in movies, I don't want to reduce them to their taste in movies. That would be, it's not that it would be unfair, it would just be inaccurate. Like I'm discovering this in the thrift store that, you know, people come in and they're really damaged and they're drug addicts and they're hurt, you know, and it's so easy to just get... you know, to just relate to the surface and just relate to the behaviors and the neuroses, and rather than take the whole human being and acknowledge that there are aspects of that person that I can't evaluate, and I won't ever get to see them if I just interact with the surface that is telling me I can define this person and then interacting with my own definition of them, right?
I want to riff on that and bring it back to what we were talking about. Another failure of the social justice narrative is that you cut yourself off from actually doing work on yourself. You also cut yourself off from seeing the strengths and the lessons that other people can teach you. You cut yourself off from the value of the white man by framing your entire existence as escaping from your own whiteness or battling whiteness, right? Reducing all these people to categories and whatever. Like it's another way of feeding into a really bad way of thinking about other people, which is that what you're saying right there with like these people who are damaged or these people who are privileged. Like if you hate the privilege, you're blind to like the value that that other person can give you. If you react negatively to somebody who's broken, you cut yourself off from establishing a connection that can enrich your life or that can possibly give them a tool or a hint or a glimpse of a better life.
And again, that inherent hypocrisy / contradiction, like if you're seeing privileged people as to blame, or if you're seeing privileged people as somehow beyond the pale, deplorable because of it, then you're acknowledging that privilege is a terrible burden, that they've actually been, you know, they're victims of their privilege. So why isn't that, allowed into the... But the reason is because, as I say, people are not thinking, never mind compassionately, they're not even thinking rationally.
Yes, yes.
And certainly, and maybe, I mean, a lot of this, I would say, you know, narcissistic irrationality and this outrage, I think it is justified by the belief that if you're emoting heavily, you're being authentic, and even... You know, it's like it's coming from the heart is the idea. This is my truth. You know, and my truth is to feel unsafe and to feel persecuted and angry, and then I'm going to act on my anger. And I think there is some, again, as in with these liminal rituals, they're acted out in a way that's unconscious, so they become counterproductive. But there is some truth in acknowledging one's feelings and expressing them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to bring it back to diaper land, which is preschool. It's like the child dominates the room through volume and immediacy. I want it now, and I'm going to be loud about it. The adult dominates the room through perspective and consistency. You control the room. You'll allow the child to control the moment, but you control the situation. And because you control the situation, you can control the child, because the child's just going to go into another state, right? Because the child doesn't have the ability to be consistent through time. So the same thing with the thergic or the Dionysian, the outburst of the social justice, the Antifa, the protest. It's all in the moment. It's all right here and instantaneous, and it feels right. It feels like I'm overcoming and I'm toppling something, but it doesn't have the perspective to actually understand that, no, everything needs to be strategic. If I'm going to be violent, it has to be very limited, very small, very targeted in order to make a point so that people will become aware of it, and then I will gain more and more allies. And what they do to excuse themselves with the whole forming allies is they have this formula that an ally is somebody that obeys me, or a good person is somebody who's obedient.
Right.
That's good. That's value. Because it goes back to Nietzsche. It goes back to that slave morality. The only way that you can show your goodness is by performing in a way that that prostrates yourself into my will. The good and bad is all about my will. And it's all about power. It's not about justice. It's about power.
Mm. Well, earlier when you were talking, if I can remember now, you were talking about how everything now, how we interact with other people requires a measuring of points. How many points do they have versus how many points I have?
Yeah.
In terms of marginality, oppression, victim status, and so on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And did you see that episode of Black Mirror, which was kind of satirizing the social network culture, where basically everyone was interacting through cell phones, and every interaction got graded, so they got points for it, and then according to their points, that determined their social status, from moment to moment basis. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it reminded me of that, and that made me think that one of the things we're seeing, I think, is a kind of dehumanization it's almost so we're imitating our technology, and I don't think that it's going to be literally that or reduce that, because we've created the technology that we imitate, so it's obviously going to go further back. We're creating technology as a way to compensate for something, you know, our own lack of connectivity is the obvious way, right? But somehow the technology is making it worse, as is so often the case when we have
an abundance of connectivity now.
Yeah, but it's not intimate, and it's kind of reinforcing the reactivity and the miscommunications and this tendency that you're saying to gauge people by their preferences, by their likes, by their identifications, their Facebook profile and so on, and then interact with that in a sort of marketing way. It's almost like we're becoming algorithmic or something. We just got to calculate.
That's a really good point. There's been this spate of articles now, and now a spate of social justice activism, where you target somebody by going through their history. You go through their social history, their network history, and you see what they said 10 years ago. There's also an article that was written about somebody, I can't remember all the details, but somebody actually wrote an article that was based around another person and what they liked on Twitter. Not even what they said, but what they liked on Twitter showed that they were connected to something that was connected to, that was something that was connected to something that we can say was might be a little bit alt-right, right? So just because this guy likes somebody that connects to this, now they're alt-right. And I wonder if that article was just like, it was clickbait. And so it was a reduction of like, well, how do I talk about this person in order for the algorithm to connect to other people? I need some dirt. So I'm gonna use this algorithmic dirt to stain them so that I have, it's bad thinking, but it just makes me wonder if like, that's just another trying to, a backhanded legitimization of something that doesn't really mean anything anyways, right? Just so you have dirt on somebody.
Sure. Well, isn't it like something that we learn to do as children, as we get betrayed, abandoned, disappointed, traumatized, abused, you know, whatever level it's at, there's always going to be disappointments in childhood. And of course, for a child, it's not intellectual disappointment, it's emotional affect. It goes into the body, and if it's very early, it determines how we configure our identity, our value system. And I think we basically build these filters over our perception and our emotional life and our feeling life and our ability to connect and be compassionate, which is sort of algorithmic. As soon as we detect a similar quality to, you know, what traumatized us in the past, we're just, you know, nobody here, not sorry, not gonna connect there.
Yeah. There is definitely, and this is another slogan. What's happening within the activist radicalism circles is the normalization of pathology and the pathologization of normalcy.
Right.
So to be normal is to be bad, yeah. And to be unnormal is to be good. And well, it's a weird thing because there's certain sorts of maladaptive behaviors. There's certain sorts of behaviors that don't help you, don't help society. And those behaviors are somehow becoming the norm, and that you can't speak out against them because they're a part of like this weird psychodrama.
And they're persecuted. Like, it's like, cause perversity, I mean, the whole concept of perversity is now associated with a persecutory patriarchal drive. I.e. If you try and identify a behavior as perverse or as even as paraphilia, then you're part of the persecutory drives that, you know, caused homosexuals to commit suicide.
So judgment itself is corrupted. You can only judge things that, and this is why the progressive ideology is another reason that it's inconsistent, because they want to have the ability to judge everything by stripping the judgment or vilifying judgment itself as somehow evil in its root, right? It's the same thing with anti-authoritarianism. It's like, we want an authority that's anti-authoritarian. We want judgment that's anti-judgment. We're going to undermine judgment, and then we're just going to replace it with our judgment. We're going to underline oppression and replace it with our own oppression. And I always feel bad talking about this way, because I feel like I'm really reducing a lot of different actors and a lot of different entities and a lot of different forces into like one emergent hypocrisy. But it's just another inconsistency that I see a lot in what I...
Well, I mean, you could feel bad about that, but you could also see it as democratic. I do see it as symptomatic of a collective schismogenesis, to use a fancy term, collective... I am aware of the whole thing of pathologizing, and one shouldn't pathologize, and like everything, it gets taken to extremes, but there is a danger in diagnosing a condition that can feed into a sort of rejection of it. But on the other hand, like, you look at the symptoms and the symptoms themselves do indicate, they kind of speak for themselves. And I think that the symptoms that we're talking about here, they are collective. It's just that they're much more exaggerated, much more apparent in certain demographics. Mm-hmm. And those that get more organized, or they get more active, or they get more coverage. I mean, who knows? It's one of the things that confuses me about this whole thing, and one of the things that would draw me to your work, because you're interpreting it and sort of crunching it, is, you know, how much can we trust the narratives that we're being given around this? I mean, obviously around anything, but I mean specifically around this, because the sense that I get when I spend time looking at this, like some of the examples you brought up today, is the sense that the human race is just going completely insane and there's really nothing that we can do about it. But that's not my experience on a day-to-day basis. So I live in a town called Hope. I did find out that there is that demographic here, because as I wrote in the piece I sent you, there was an attempt to question a program that was pressing for, you know, gender tolerance for transgender and for all kinds of sexual orientation, and just the whole new progressive thing is being pushed in the educational system here in Canada, or has been implemented from kindergarten all the way up to universities. So if you thought it was bad before, it's getting worse, right? And then there was a group that wanted to question this, and they were absolutely reviled, and they were compared to Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. So I found out, whoa, okay, so this is going on in my town. And then I wrote about it in the newsletter, and then I found out that people were glad that I'd written about it, and because they were afraid to speak up.
Yeah, okay? But
they were still, I still think they're in the majority in my town, is the point I'm making. So it's as though there's some sort of distortion of the narrative, which maybe... the fault may be in the interpreters to some extent, but I think it's also a deliberate kind of engineering, as in the voices of outrage have a way, even you were saying that they're not strategic, but maybe there's just an instinctive way that they are strategic, because they make enough noise. Who the hell wants to deal with it? And people just go along with it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's certain sorts of values that have been espoused by this radical activism contingent that gets their point across, and they're leaning on certain sorts of human behaviors. They're expecting that most people will be forced to go along with them and not speak out, because courage is statistically small, yeah. especially in North American societies. Like, we're just like do our work, get home, eat, sleep, go back to work. You know, like, I don't want to kick up the waves, you know, like, well, look at those people. They want to change the world. Like, I don't want to be targeted by them. And what happened at Evergreen was that Brett Weinstein stood up. It's like, okay, you can target me, but it doesn't matter because what you're saying doesn't make any sense. But they still went full throttle. And he was, for whatever reason, able to withstand that. But most people didn't. And if there was probably six other professors, maybe even four other professors at Evergreen State College that stood with Brett, stood against that mob, stood on behalf of the, what was it? 10% of the college, well, no, it was 5% of the college participated in those actions. Hmm. But the whole college is known for that now. Hmm. And if there was like just a few more bodies that stood up, that stood their ground, like that mob would have had to have adapted itself, or at least more people would have stood up, right? There's a tipping point for the radicalism to be put in its place. But the radicalism is leaning on the fact that it's pretty unlikely that any one person's going to stand up, let alone four, mm-hmm. let alone 20. If there's 20, then there's no way it would happen anymore. Because it might have to do with some sort of change in our culture where we're more passive and we're more acquiescent, or we're scared of being conservative. We're scared of, like, you know, being cowed by labels of alt-right or Ku Klux Klan or racist for questioning. To question the anti-racism means that I'm a racist. And that's something that, another reason I did these videos is because I had to work that stuff out of me, right? I had to go through and just, you know, and in my early work, I was like always apologizing. I was really scared, right? I'm like, oh no, I'm questioning. I'm a racist now. Or I'm questioning. I'm a homophobe. I'm a transphobe because I'm questioning this stuff. And I try to make it clear. I'm like, no, I can be compassionate and critical at the same time. I can be a progressive and want to have nothing to do with this illiberalism, right? And so my work is to try to empower other people to stand up against it, because if we don't stand up against it, it's overrepresented. It's statistically overrepresenting itself because of its tactics.
Sure. Yeah. I think there's a danger in that, because they, and again, I'm also hesitant to make it about a they, but that kind of energy or that kind of human expression actually thrives on being opposed. Like, we know that. It's born from that, right? So standing against it, the danger is it makes the thing stronger that's being stood against. And it goes both ways, of course. Both Weinstein and Peterson would not have become the mega celebrities they are today if they hadn't been controversial by standing up against something that refuses to be stood up to and therefore reacts to it, and therefore the whole thing avalanches, right, and snowballs. So I was going to say, oh, I'm in the same business as you, but actually it's subtly different, because my and it isn't my whole aim, but I think it's very central, is giving an example of I don't want to say fearless, but of intrepid self-expression, where I will talk about things that people don't want to talk about, that aren't supposed to talk about. I will put my neck on the line, but it's not an activism. It's not a position. I need to be able to, as you were saying for yourself, I need to be able to express myself freely in my life, because how am I possibly going to live my life or discover what I have within me if I can't express it? That's the way we discover it. We don't just look and see what's there. It has to come out for us to see it. So, and Peterson, this is one of the things I like about him that he talks about, is that, yeah, to discover who we are and what we're made of, we need to be able to articulate and express. And to do that, we need an environment in which we can do it. But it sort of goes both ways. If the environment isn't like that, then we need to just do it anyway and help to create that environment for ourselves locally. And then if others see it and they're inspired by it, absolutely, that's great. But I don't see it as are standing against something. It's again about being anti-anti. I don't, it's standing for something, which is, the willingness to go out on a limb and just say what's going on with me and not care about being condemned for it, or at least not care enough to. I mean, I've said this to many people, like you, who are afraid of saying things on my podcast that somebody might hear. I say to them, well, it's not many, but a few times, you know, which do you think is worse, that you might offend somebody or that you don't feel free to express yourself? You know, just if you weigh those two up, which seems more important? And I think it's really obvious, like the kind of condemnation that we're in danger of receiving or generating isn't really that serious. I mean, somebody can call you or I a racist or an anti-Semite or whatever it would be, homophobe, you know, there's a list now, of course, of things that can destroy your career. Well, it wouldn't destroy my career. You know, in the thrift store, I mean, it might mess up. I mean, it just came up recently. I was watching a video about the last one about comedy, and what you were talking about today, when they go back and look at people's past history, and then they dredge it up, and then they try and make you apologize for it in the moment, and if you don't, that's it. Well, yeah, that could happen to me at any time if I get, for whatever reason, I'm considered a threat in ways that aren't obviously incorrect, then somebody could sift through and say, don't listen to this guy because he said this about that, right?
Yeah.
So sure, it could happen. But I don't see that that's really a very high stake, even though I think it is built into a psychologically, like the fear of being ostracized.
You
can die in a literal situation as an infant, for one thing, but also in olden days in a community, if you got ostracized, you could.
Well, one way of defending ourselves against that is by creating community, making alliances, while at the same time being aware of tribalism or wary of tribalism, right?
Yeah.
So in on the YouTube sphere, I kind of have to go in a little bit, but in the YouTube sphere, there was this whole thing called the skeptic community, who are anti-social justice. And they made video after video after video of, like, you know, going after social justice warriors, as anti-SJWs, right?
Yeah.
And that movement had a heyday, and I'm sure there's certain people who have moved beyond it. But as kind of a thing, it was a fad, right? So they staked their work on being against another thing. But once you defeat that other thing, you have to find another thing to be against if your whole modality is being against. Yeah. And that's one thing, like, where I don't want to just be a compassionate critic. I want to be a creative critic. I want to be somebody that's building things. I try to take things apart in a way that we can create more meaning out of them. That's one of the things I studied with criticism, with literary criticism. It's not about breaking down a story. It's about making more of the story. It's about enlarging the story, taking a story and showing how it can mean all these different, more and more and more, and giving the story meaning. That's the true creative criticism, right? And I don't know if I necessarily do that when I break down something that I'm completely against, when I go against some sort of New York Times op-ed that wants me to act in a certain way or shut up or stay on my lane or something like that. I want to break down bad ideas for sure, but I want to do it in such a way that I will always have more work to do. I don't want to run out of work or just pit myself. As one of the things I rejected very early on in my intellectual life was againstness. I do not want to be against. I don't want to be that which is against, because then I will never run out of, I will never build anything. And my virtue is in building.
Mm. Well, it's a negative identity as well. And that's that. That is a constantly being in a defense posture.
Yeah.
Potentially, if one, and you know, I run into this risk in my own work. I'm aware of it, like, because I'm always focusing on the negative stuff, the dark stuff. But, and so that can be compulsive, obsessive, and it can, end up to an overly pessimistic point of view, for one thing. But I don't feel like I am a pessimist. I also feel like I'm very optimistic, and I'm hesitant to mirror you there and say the feeling of building something, but I do think my approach is complementary with yours. I see it more as the story that I'm deconstructing is a cover story, and so once it's deconstructed, the true story will be revealed. I mean that literally, but also figuratively. Like there's
you're an archaeologist.
Yeah, I'm discovering. Well, except that an archaeologist discovers dead things. So, you know, hopefully I'm discovering, the real foundation of human community that's been co-opted and diverted and perverted through all these replicating, ever complexifying ideologies. I do think there's a foundation of human beingness and interaction that is echoed by the religions, even though I don't think we can just kind of go back to the old ways, but I do think we can refer to that and as a sort of compass, and underneath the narratives that we've built, there is coherence there, that we don't actually have to create it, although I think we do have to be creative to be deconstructive. Like you've got to be imaginative, right?
I think one of the things that you're doing is built into how you're doing it. Like you just said that you want to go down to the roots of community. You want to get to the foundation of what human community is. And I think that the podcast, the long form discussion, is a way of modeling that. You're not just deconstructing everything, you're actually practicing what you want. You're manifesting community and connection and stuff like that. So I think that it's a kind of a winning strategy. I don't know if it's intentional or not.
That's absolutely right. You nailed it. And it's important to always remember that, like today having conversation with you, like there's all these things we want to deconstruct, but the thing that's most important to me is to forge a connection to you that's meaningful as two human beings struggling with in liminal times.
Yeah, in liminal times.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. Tired of listening to these words, I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen
That's the end of my conversation with Benjamin Boyce. You can follow Benjamin on YouTube, as linked in the show notes. Next week, Boxing Day podcast is with David Constanza of Art of Flying. After that, who knows, in the new year 2019, we shall see. Thank you for my donators. Thank you to my donators, even, for the donations. I'm continuing my YouTube live broadcast experiment. Next one, I think, is now going to be on a Sunday due to something I have already on the Saturday. So probably it will be a Sunday at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's a day after the usual time, and the subject will be the second Matrix. Tune into that by subscribing at my YouTube channel, or simply emailing me, letting me know you're interested.
These words are yours. These words. These words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only one voice.